afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of September 27th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technical Content at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We're glad that you're with us because we have a great panel lined up today. The table is a little fuller than normal, and that's a good thing because we've got some voices you're used to, and at least one voice that's not as common here on the show, but I think someone who's going to bring some great insight to the proceedings. Well, let's get started telling you who they are. To begin with, we have Kelly Sheridan, who is our keeper on the eye of everything that is Microsoft and a bunch of other stuff here at Information Week. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Glad that you were able to make it to the office through all of the mountains of confetti and other stuff that must have been left after the Pope's visit.
Yeah, it's no worse than New Year's in Times Square, right?
Is anything worse than New Year's in Times Square, though? That's a topic for another day as we compare natural disasters to New Year's Eve at Times Square. Well, someone who's well away from Times Square is the executive editor for Community here at Information Week, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. But wherever I go, they still drop confetti for me, so it feels like Times Square.
You know, I was trying to keep straight whether it was the confetti behind you or the rose petals in front of you. I appreciate you clearing that up for us. And someone also far, far away from Times Square, we're happy to have with us today, Information Week's editor-at-large for cloud stuff, Charlie Babcock. Charlie, welcome to Information Week Live.
Well, Kurt, it's nice to be here. Unfortunately, the only confetti I see is when the Giants win the World Series.
And
that's not going to happen this year.
I was going to say, we won't talk about just how often that happens, but we're glad to have you with us because we're glad to have your voice here on the radio and wanted to get started by going around and asking something I ask often. So, panel members, for you, what was the big item in the IT news this week? Kelly, we'll start with you. What was your big news item for the week?
Sure. Well, I think some of my news might overlap with Charlie's because it was a big week for Microsoft Azure. But I would say some of the biggest news items coming from that space were the public release of Exchange Server 2016. That happened this week, and yeah, that's what I would pick for the biggest one, but we can go into some of the smaller ones later.
Okay, well, since Kelly mentioned the cloud, Charlie, let's turn over to you. Was that your biggest news of the week as well, or were there other things that you thought were just as big as Microsoft's announcement?
Well, as a cloud writer, I have to make the cloud the biggest news of the week. But GE held its Minds and Machines conference in San Francisco, and that cuts across all clouds in a sense. The Internet of Things is really gathering steam to mix the machine age with the digital age metaphors there. GE has had four Minds and Machines conferences. This year's was the largest, with about 1,000 people attending, and Microsoft, Amazon, GE, they all want to participate in the machine data that's going to pour off the Internet of Things.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Internet of Things because that's something that just it keeps shifting and moving and morphing, and it's one of the topics that I really think a lot of people in the popular press get very wrong because they look only at things like intelligent thermostats in the house and wearable devices like the Apple Watch. And those may or may not turn out to be really big things, but the stuff that goes on in and around process control and transportation and industrial automation, I think that's going to be really big, and I think that's going to have some changes not only on business but society that we've only begun to see. Charlie, do you think I'm way off base with that?
No, Kurt, you're right on. There's going to be a huge difference between what I would call the industrial Internet of Things and the consumer Internet of Things. There's a big difference between wiring your thermostat to your, let's say, your dishwasher, or something silly like that, or connecting, let's say, your scales to the internet, so all your relatives can learn that you're getting fat. That's not what we're talking about when we get to the industrial internet or Internet of Things on an industrial scale. GE put on stage the example of the managers of a $19 billion liquefied natural gas plant. And they talked about how collecting data from around their plant allowed them to spot what were minor technical problems, but find them and troubleshoot them before they became problems that could disrupt the operation of a piece of equipment. And they kept emphasizing it was not a big thing that we found. It was not a big problem that we corrected. But what we did was prevent some unplanned downtime. And when you think of reliability of expensive, big industrial machines and making that reliability closer to 100%, you get a sense of how important this is to anyone who knows what the cost of that capital equipment is.
Yes, and especially when it comes to things like refineries. We don't have nearly as many in the U.S. as most people think, so when one goes down on an unplanned basis, it's something that really can hit lots and lots of people right in the wallet as the price of gasoline goes up. Well, Dave, we've left you sort of quiet over in your corner of the studio today. Is your big story of the week also cloud-related, or did you see something else out there that was worthy of top spot on your list?
Well, I have to say that the biggest news in the terms of the thing that people are reading about, we've probably covered. However, the thing which is probably going to have the biggest impact in the long run was something else Charlie covered this week, which is an IBM breakthrough with carbon nanotubes. And I've been covering nanotubes for quite a while, and I'm a big fan, as people who have been reading me know. But this is the kind of breakthrough that could lead to an entire paradigm shift in the way we think about computing and the way computers work. And it could be a big thing, extremely low power usage, but high computing power computers, potentially smartphones that never have to be charged again once they're charged first at the factory. There are huge benefits and possibilities to carbon nanotubes, and I think that breakthrough is going to send ripples through the industry over the next couple of years.
Okay. Now, Charlie, this is indeed one of the articles that you wrote. As a matter of fact, it's currently on Information Week's homepage. So from your standpoint, do you think Dave is overselling carbon nanotubes, or do you think that he's pretty much spot on with what they can do for us going forward?
Oh, Dave would never oversell, would he? But yes, he's spot on. It's very hard even to describe the potential impact. I had the chance to talk with Shu-Jen Han, one of the lead researchers on that project, this morning, and my eyes were opened further as to what its potential is. We still do not have a manufacturing process for what we're talking about. So in that sense, we're doing things in the lab that are very impressive, but until you can bring them to a manufacturing process, it's theoretical gains, not concrete ones that we're going to put in our pocket or put on our hip as a new mobile device. But The carbon nanotube as a transistor is 10 times more efficient than a silicon transistor. The problem is the electrical current or the electrical hole, as it's sometimes also called, moves across the transistor so quickly that the metal contact point becomes a point of interference. The resistance of the metal actually slows down the operation of the transistor once you get to the nanotube type of process. And the breakthrough that IBM claims, and it does sound like a breakthrough, is it's not enough to build transistors out of nanotubes, which several parties have done, including IBM, but also Stanford and MIT, I believe. You need to be able to make use of the transistor by giving it contact points that link to something else in the device. And that has been a huge problem, rendering much of the kind of the transistor research moot because they could not get the electrical impulses off the transistor fast enough to make use of the very high nanotube speeds, make use of them, and then start building much smaller transistors and packing them into devices.
Yeah, I think in terms of design, one of the other things that a lot of people don't realize is that when you get up to very high speeds, electrons don't like corners. And so you end up having to redesign stuff. I've seen a lot of interesting leading-edge designs that are round or are even spherical because you have to curve the leads that you're using to sort of gently shepherd these quickly moving electrons around your design, because if you have sharp curves, the electrons are capable of just sort of shooting off into space, which doesn't help much of anyone. I think it's fascinating what's going to have to happen with the basic design of the circuits in order to take advantage of things like this. But certainly, they seem like a real option for giving us further life on Moore's Law. And
Yes.
I'd also love to get your take on one of the stories that I wrote this week. And I was trying to look to see if it's made it to the page yet. I don't think it has, but I wrote a piece that's going to be coming up soon. Keep an eye out for it, on quantum computers. And the great thing about quantum computers is that while they are doing what they do, it's impossible to look at them to tell if they're working. And so I'm going to ask the panel, what do you think is going to have the bigger impact going forward? Something like nanotubes, which are basically a materials breakthrough, or something like quantum computing, which is a basic architectural breakthrough. Dave, I'm going to turn to you first. What do you think?
Well, I have to admit, I have not followed quantum computing quite as much. But my general feeling from what I have followed is that we're probably a little bit closer on a materials breakthrough for carbon nanotubes than we are on quantum computing on any sort of a consumer scale. So my prediction, with not as much education as I wish I had on the topic, is that we'll see carbon nanotube run transistors, computers in our pockets and in our offices, making a major impact before we see quantum computing making an impact. But in the end, I think the potential for quantum computing is even greater.
Okay. I'm not going to be able to argue against that right now, possibly because I'm setting my mind off to do quantum things and all of the probability fields haven't collapsed yet. But Kelly, I want to turn to you. What do you think? We don't often get you involved in the sort of hardware architecture questions, but what do you think on this? Is the advancement of computing tied up, you think, in materials or in essentially extending what we're doing now or in some radical new architecture to come?
Well, I don't, well, like Dave said, I don't follow quantum computing enough to make an educated guess on that point. I think both of them have tremendous implications, and I actually really liked reading Charlie's article on the nanotubes because that's something that I hadn't spent too much time following. And then I started reading Charlie's article and like clicking all the links around, and it's so interesting. But like he said, until we find a way to manufacture this type of technology, it's kind of just a faraway idea. It's a really cool idea, and it has massive implications, but right now I think right now everything is just kind of like guesswork.
Okay. And I appreciate a good editor and reporter not wanting to do too much guesswork. Well, Charlie, that brings us back to you. You wrote the piece on nanotubes, but what do you think? Are we basically locked into a materials and process game, or do you see something bigger and architectural out there on the horizon that's going to save us from the plodding nature of our traditional electronic binary computers?
Well, Kurt, did you say we don't know whether the quantum computer is running or not?
Well, we know that it, I mean, we can see that it's drawing electricity, but unlike our normal digital computers where you can set, you know, do sort of set points, with a quantum computer, if you look at the results to see what's going on, that act of looking collapses all the probability fields and sort of brings everything to a screeching halt.
Well, I'd like to put in a request for a quantum curtain, so my bosses won't know whether I'm working or not.
I think I
well,
have
you know, we,
bosses who would swear that I had that in place anyway.
Charlie, just like anything else, though, we know how much you've been working by your output, just like the finish of a quantum computer. So you don't need to worry about that. We can still see the end result.
Well, you've got to be careful of the garbage in, garbage out principle there. But at any rate, I don't know enough about the quantum computing. But since I don't see IBM investing in it, and I know IBM very much wants to dominate or wants to have a big stake in the next generation of computers that comes out of the factory, I don't believe quantum is in the same league of immediate production, and by that I mean the next 5 years. Sujen Han said this morning that it's within 5 years that they could move transistor sizes below 10 nanometers, the level at which the semiconductor phase of computing is expected to go, but not necessarily below 10 nanometers. The nanotubes can go down below 10, he said, and they might wait for production until they can get to the 3 to 5 nanometer stage of nanotubes. And if that's the case, he thought it might be a little longer time frame, 7 to 10 years before they produce. If they were to stick with a 10 nanometer transistor, then they could conceivably produce in the next 5 years. If somebody tells me quantum computers will be competing with that time frame, then I'm all ears. But I know how difficult it is to get to production phases of things that are done in the lab. And so until I hear something about quantum being close to production, I'll just keep my eye on the nanotubes, I guess.
Well,
Go
ahead.
Oh, sorry, Kurt. Oh, no, I was just going to say what's interesting about what Charlie just said there is that, in my mind, the biggest proponent of quantum computing from an existing sort of large enterprise point of view was Google. And I think it shows the Google versus IBM mindset in a lot of ways, which is that Google likes to go for the long-term big score. And IBM, while certainly keeping its eye on research in the future and a big patent, you know, maven, they do tend to think in shorter time frames. And I think it's a pretty fascinating view of the two companies and which technology they're backing there.
Well, you know, the thing that I was going to say is it's interesting because IBM actually is one of the leading companies doing research in quantum computing. And with the piece that I wrote, and I did find it, it certainly has been published. And I'm putting the link for that into the online discussion here for the show. But one of the slams against the D-Wave quantum computer that both Google and NASA and some others have invested in is that the IBM researchers say, well, it's not real quantum. That what we're doing is quantum computing. What they're doing is not really quantum computing. And as I said, the difficulty is that it is essentially impossible to look at the process while it's going on to tell, because as soon as you look, everything collapses and you get an answer. Now, one of the things that I love about quantum computing is that you get the answer very, very quickly, because basically in quantum computing, the circuitry, such as it is, will compute all of the possible answers simultaneously. And it only collapses all of them down to one when you ask it for the answer. The downside is that the answer it gives you is only statistically likely to be correct. And so in order to narrow down, to tighten the window in correctness, you have to ask it the question multiple times and see which answer you get most often. It really is, as Charlie said, it's an entirely different way of looking at problems. And it's an entirely different way of designing algorithms. In theory, quantum computing can address problems that traditional computing cannot. There are certain problems that are simply intractable by normal computer science methods. And in theory, quantum computing can handle it, but no one knows if it's really going to work that well or ultimately work faster than traditional computing, because you do have to ask it the question over and over and over again to statistically get it to give you something that's the most likely to be correct. It's one of those areas of thought that makes my head hurt. And part of me loves that, and part of me longs for a really good abacus. So it will be interesting to see. I'm glad that we've got multiple levels of research and multiple directions of research, but it really will, I think, be interesting to see which one bears fruit in the long term.
I'd love to see companies deal with that, because I think it would feel much like a magic eight ball to them.
Yes. Yes.
Answer unclear. Ask again.
A magic eight ball in multiple dimensions. And we all know how much the data-driven executive loves answers that are unclear. Well, speaking of getting answers, we're getting towards that time of the program where we get to turn to something that does often look out a little bit further, and that's the geek end. Dave, I'll admit I've been busy writing and doing other stuff today, and I haven't had a chance to look at the geek end. So why don't you tell us all what you found?
Well, actually, there's a reason. Excuse me. There's a reason nobody's seen it. It isn't up yet, and the reason it's not up yet is that there's a new developing aspect to it. So today, I'll be looking at a new mobile app called People, P-E-E-P-L-E. that is being called by some slander as a service, and by others, the worst creation of the internet to date. However, interestingly enough, the people who are behind it seem to be the nicest, sweetest, sort of naively optimistic people you'll ever meet. And that's why this story is interesting. People is being billed as essentially Yelp for people. It allows you to rate, against another person's will, which is the major complaint, a person based on one of three character traits: how they were romantically, how they were professionally, or how they are personally, which I guess we're supposed to assume is the generic third category. And you rate them from 1 to 5 stars, and you leave them a review, just like a restaurant. And not surprisingly, some people are looking at this as an incredible invasion of privacy. They're worried about some ex-employee or ex-girlfriend or boyfriend or just somebody with an axe to grind putting a life-ruining review online about a person that they can neither change nor delete nor opt out of in any way. However, the people who are connected to people are saying, hey, but wait a minute. You spend your whole life trying to be a good person. You have people who like you. You have people who care about you. You have people who think you're really good at your job. Why don't you want to give them a chance to show how good a person you are? And there is sort of an interesting social point here, which is I was thinking about how essentially, our lives have changed from the sort of 1950s, we all live in neighborhoods where everybody knows us sort of ideal that may or may not have existed. When you meet somebody in that small town, you already know whether they are a good person or a bad person. In our 21st century world, where we come across strangers on a daily basis, whether we want to date them or have them take care of our children or possibly bring a gun into the office or whatever it is that they're going to do, we basically have to use kinds of snap judgments. Oh, this person seems okay. I guess they're okay. I guess I'll trust them to take care of my children, or I guess I'll trust them to take me on a date, or to drive my Uber. So in a way, that actually creates a kind of bias, almost a racism in some cases of, oh, this person seems okay, that I think is sort of frightening. So if I could dial up really quickly my Uber driver's profile before I got in the car, or a man or woman I was about to date to find out what other people thought about them, this isn't such a bad service. So it's very controversial. It is well-meaning, but it has a lot of flaws, including the inability to opt out. So I thought it was a very, very interesting story. And the reason we have not run it yet is because their site is currently down, and we believe they might actually be in the midst of an attack. And I have reached out to them to see if they want to comment or not. It's possible that they've just shut the site down because of the publicity. We're not sure, but they are running Cloudflare, which is a DDoS attack protection software on their site right now. So I'm very curious. I'm not saying that they are under attack. I have no ability to confirm that in any way. But that's why we're holding off the article, because there's definitely something going on we'd really love to hear a comment on them about.
So basically the same internet that would never say something bad about a person without justification might have taken their site down.
Exactly. Now, you know, of course, I don't want them to be under an attack, and they may not be under an attack. They may just be overwhelmed by positive, wonderful reviews, for all I know. But there's definitely controversy of some sort going around that app right now.
Well, for Charlie and Kelly, have you heard about this app? If you have, what do you think about it?
I've heard about it. I can't decide how creepy it is. Because if you think about it, this is something that we already do on social media every day. Like, we say the good and the bad about everything and everyone in the world. I think the fact that this takes it to a more personal level, so people are used to reading, like, discrimination or positive things about other people online, but this is something that can personally affect them. I think that's what's freaking people out.
That, Charlie? And the fact that you've only got three choices to sum up a human personality, I mean, what, three areas, and it strikes me that and the best people, those areas overlap heavily, and you know, personal qualities trespass on, infiltrate in good ways, the professional life, et cetera, that the whole thing has got a bunch of dubious constructs that everyone starts conforming to, and then we get some dubious results. I don't know. I'm highly skeptical here.
You know, I think I'm going to join the panel in the skepticism, because on the one hand, I think that something like this is almost inevitable, given what goes on with sites on the web these days. We tend to make sport of rating and ranking pretty much everything else. Why we shouldn't just, you know, go around randomly rating other human beings. It's a logical follow-on. But I do think there are a lot of real problems with it. And the thing that I worry about is, Charlie, exactly what you alluded to. In the same way that when we started doing this high-stakes testing in schools, teachers started almost immediately doing what people call teaching to the test. In other words, they started building their curriculum around the test and essentially teaching nothing that isn't going to be covered on a test. So we have managed to throttle and limit what is taught in many, many schools. And I hate the thought that people would do the same sort of thing to their behavior, try to alter who they present themselves to be to the rest of the world based upon the limited factors that would go into a ranking like this. Dave, I'm going to be looking forward to that article when it does go up. I think it's going to be an interesting thing, and I suspect this is one of those stories that we will talk about more than once here on Information Week Live. Well, I'm afraid that with that, we've come to the end of this week's Information Week Live. So it's time to go around the virtual table and talk about what people are going to be doing for the coming week. Kelly, we'll start with you. What do you have your eyes on for the coming week? Anything that we should be eagerly anticipating coming out under your byline in the next few days?
Absolutely. On Tuesday, Microsoft is holding a Windows 10 hardware launch in New York City, and it's right around the corner from the office, so I will be there. So I would keep an eye out for updates on the different devices that they're going to be unveiling within the next few days.
Very good. Well, we've been talking about this latest social website. How should people keep up with you on the existing social media?
Twitter is my social media of choice, and you can find me at Kelly Sheridan. That's Sheridan 22.
Outstanding. Well, we will certainly do that. Kelly, thanks for being with us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie, we'll turn to you. I know that you tend to have a lot going on, a lot of things that you're keeping your eye on. So what should we be on the lookout for from your computer in the coming days?
Well, next week is the big week for Amazon when it holds its annual developer and user conference, reInvent. So I'll be reporting on that. I expect lots of new IT-type services coming out of Amazon. They're adding hundreds of services now per year, if you count all the little variations. And it adds up to a great deal of information for the Amazon customer or the prospective Amazon customer.
Outstanding. Well, we will look forward to that. And where should we look for you on all of the various social media?
Oh, yes, that would be Babcock CW, at Babcock CW on Twitter.
Well, we will all, if you're not following Charlie and you're interested in anything having to do with cloud and open source, you really ought to be following him. He keeps up with that and does great work on all of that. And Charlie, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Great to be here, Kurt.
Well, Dave, I think I have a clue about what you're going to be doing next week, but why don't you fill everyone in on what's ahead for you?
Yep, I will be flying down to Florida to see the Gartner CIO Symposium and, of course, your smiling face. I'll be covering Gartner Live the entire week. Also, I have a slideshow on hottest IT jobs for 2016 that should be out any day, and an article on Japan deploying a fleet of automated taxis, driverless taxis, for the 2020 Olympics.
Ooh, driverless taxis. That would be interesting. Although I've got to admit that my experience is that taxi cab drivers in Japan are among the most polite in the world. So I kind of hate to see that go away to any extent. But we'll certainly look for all that. And Dave, how should people be following you to keep up with what you're going to be doing down at Gartner?
Sure. At Twitter, at GeekendDave. That's weekend, but with a G, Dave.
Well, I will look forward to seeing you in Orlando. And as Dave said, I'll also be there covering the Gartner Symposium and IT Expo next week. Lot of interesting stuff going on. I've made appointments to see a number of companies, talk to several executives. I'll be covering that. I'm going to be covering it on social media, including trying a couple of new things. So please be sure to follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA, and I'll be doing live video using Periscope, which is Twitter's long-form video cousin. My handle on Periscope is also at KG4GWA. We'll see how that goes. I've never covered an event using Periscope. I'm going to see how that works out for everyone. But on Twitter and Periscope, I'm at KG4GWA. Well, if you are listening to this on the streaming on-demand version, we're happy to have you as our listener. Glad you took the time to do it, but we would love to have you as a live listener. You know, this comes to you live every week at 3 p.m. Eastern, and we've got a great conversation that happens at informationweek.com around the radio program. We would love to have your voice as part of that. You can interact with all the panelists and all of the folks who are in the audience. They would love to hear from you as well. Well, we will, in fact, be back next week. Dave and I will have lots of Gartner goodness to bring you, and we'll see how many other folks we can get around the big virtual table here in the studio. But I'd like to thank our panelists this week, Kelly Sheridan, Dave Wagner, and Charlie Babcock. Thanks to one and all. Thanks to you for listening. Hey, please join us again. We'll see you next week.